This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hi, I'm Lizzie Campbell.
And I'm Ruth Hood.
And today we're talking to Adam Averson, who works at ALMA. Can you tell us a bit about what ALMA is?
Okay, so ALMA is the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, and it's being built in Chile, and it will be eventually a group of around 60 12-meter dishes.
You said ALMA's being built in Chile in the Atacama Desert. That's the driest place on Earth, and it's also near to a lot of volcanoes, including one of the most active in Chile. It seems like kind of a strange place to choose to work. So can you explain why the area is so suitable for the astronomy that ALMA wants to do?
The reason it's being built in the Atacama Desert is because of the dryness, and it's being built at 5,000 metres altitude, so it's quite high up as well. And that's because the electromagnetic waves that we're trying to detect are at millimeter wavelengths, which are highly absorbed by water in the atmosphere. So if you go high up, then there's less atmosphere above you, and if you go to a really dry place, there's less water in the atmosphere, so less absorption happens. So that makes it an ideal place to put this array of telescopes. As for the volcanoes, well, I assume that they thought about this when they started building them, and the telescope will be at a suitably large distance from the volcano that no immediate danger is happening. And in the case that a volcano does erupt, I assume that they just stop observations. And as well, it being at 5,000 metres, no one's actually going to be up there. It all gets controlled from a station at 2,900 metres, because you get up to 5,000 metres and you start having medical problems. So it's not a great place to go and work.
Cool. So for the listeners, can you explain how interferometry can be used to create images?
I can try. First, I recommend getting the Jodcast October 2009, in which ESO astronomer Robert Lang does an interview, which he explains all about interferometry, and he's probably going to do a much better job than I'm about to do. But very basically, an interferometer works by combining the signals from two or more telescopes. For the example of a two-telescope interferometer, if you imagine the two waves, the electromagnetic waves, coming from an object in space towards the two telescopes, one telescope will receive the signal before the other, unless the object is exactly overhead, and that's just due to the speed of light and the sort of the geometric configuration of the array. But if you know this time delay of the two waves arriving, and you can compensate for it and combine the signals together, then you effectively get the kind of information that you would get from two separate parts of a single massive dish. Now, that's not quite enough information to make an image, to get an accurate image. You can start adding dishes to increase the amount of information, so you're sort of getting more parts of this massive telescope. But the problem there comes if you're going to build a lot of smaller telescopes and then combine them all together, it's going to get very expensive and very, very technically demanding. Almost the same reason that we don't build these massive, over 100 meter dishes. So the next thing you can do, so if you've got more than two dishes, you've got quite a few going, you can use the Earth's rotation, because as the Earth rotates, the position of two dishes will change over time, and you'll start filling in more. You'll get more bits of information about the object you're looking at as the two antennas position relative to that object change over time. So eventually you'll end up with a suitable amount of information with which you can then create images, which is you use some clever bits of software that do quite a lot of very complicated maths, and you end up with a nice pretty picture coming out at the end. Just one last thing about an interferometer. The resolution you get is a function of the maximum separation of two dishes. So you can have them at kilometres, ALMA will eventually have up to 14 kilometres. A single dish radio telescope has a resolution based on the diameter of its dish. So in practicality, the biggest you can really build is around 100 metres before it gets very, very expensive and very, very engineering heavy, so that it doesn't sort of collapse under its own weight.
So ALMA's made up of an array of small antennas, and they can be moved about by transporter vehicles. What kind of benefits does this have?
Well, as I just mentioned, the separation of two dishes sets the resolution of the observations made by those two dishes when they're combined into an interferometer. So by moving them around, you can set the scales of the resolution present in the whole array, so the kind of scales you'll see in your final image. In other words, if you have an array of telescopes, the information you get about the largest scale structure is defined by the distance, the smallest distance between two dishes, and the highest resolution you get is set by the furthest distance between another set of two dishes. for a number of reasons, observations an astronomer might want to make might not require the maximum resolution, so it might not require a 14-kilometre separation of dishes, but something a bit smaller. So having the ability to move the antennas on these transporters means you can sort of reconfigure and get all kinds of different arrays that will allow you to look at all kinds of different scale sizes in the final image of the objects you're interested in looking at.
And why will the higher resolutions be useful? Will it be used to look out at further out objects, or will they be able to look at close objects in greater detail?
Well, the higher resolution will be most useful for looking at closer objects in greater detail than they've ever been seen before. So objects like massive stars as they form, we may be able to see disks around them, which is sort of a holy grail of observations at the moment. ALMA will also look at very distant galaxies, because the emission from these galaxies is redshifted due to the expansion of the universe. So as an object travelling away from you because of the expansion of the universe, the wavelength of the light gets stretched. So the original emission at shorter wavelength ends up in the observing bands, the things that ALMA can see. So looking at this redshifted light, you're effectively looking back into the past. And this means we can start looking at things that are much older and start looking at the early times of the universe.
What sort of questions about the universe will ALMA be trying to answer?
So ALMA's going to study a wide variety of objects, looking from the first stars and galaxies forming in the universe, as I was just saying about this. We can pick up emission because of the redshift of the light from these really early objects. So we're looking billions of years back, and it's tracing the very early times of the universe. And within the range of wavelengths that ALMA observes that, there are a lot of emission lines caused by transitions of electrons and the sort of the motions of molecules in interstellar space. So we're effectively getting a kind of a chemistry lab in space, so we can check out what happens to molecules and chemicals in really extreme conditions of space. So low pressures, cold temperatures, high temperatures, all kinds of things. So there's that kind of area of exploration that ALMA would be allowing us to do. And then again, the high resolution will allow us to look really closely at objects in our own galaxy and see what's going on in very fine detail.
So one of ALMA's aims is to find out more about the formation of stars. What kind of signs will you look for, and what do you hope to find out about it?
Okay, so I personally think that these types of observations, so about star formation, that will be made by ALMA will be one of the most interesting. My PhD was based around the formation of massive stars, so I am biased into thinking that, but there you go. At the moment, the formation of massive stars isn't really well understood. They tend to form further away from us than lower mass stars, and they form in giant molecular clouds like all stars do, but these are full of dust, so it obscures our view of them in the optical, and so we have to move to radio and millimeter wavelengths. The reason they're not really well understood is that from a theoretical point of view, when a star reaches a certain mass, they should start hydrogen burning, which leads them to emitting radiation, and this radiation creates an outward pressure which stops matter falling onto the star, effectively limiting the mass. So this cutoff can happen up to 7 or 8 times the mass of the Sun. But stars, like last year, one was found at 150 times the mass of the Sun. So how did they form? Which is sort of the interesting topic and what I'm interested in. So one of the ways around this problem is the accretion of matter from a disk. Radiation can escape through the polar regions, so the northern and southern hemispheres, and everywhere except the equator where the disk will be. And this is one of the benefits of ALMA's super high resolution. It's that we'll be able to start seeing these disks properly. And this is something that hasn't been done before. So that's the bit that I find really exciting.
And what makes ALMA different from other telescopes?
So ALMA is different from other telescopes is in that it covers a huge range of frequencies. So there's much more different ranges of wavelengths and things you can look at, so we're tracing all kinds of different physical processes that different. You'd have to go to a lot of different telescopes to do. Now, you can't observe all the frequencies, all the wavelengths at once, but you can apply for time and build up an image all using the same instrument, which is always good because you sort of know the workings of one problem and it makes it more comparable from one set of data to the next. And the number of antennas is much, much greater than the current millimeter interferometers that exist. So that'll allow us to get high sensitivity and good images. And again, the incredible sort of baselines that we're going to be going up to 14 kilometers is going to give us some really high resolution, so we can do all these interesting things and the sort of the reconfigurable nature, I mean, more flexibility of the kind of observations you can take.
So what's so interesting about the core universe?
Well, if we define the core universe as regions of the universe where most of the matter is in the form of either molecular gas, a liquid or a solid, then first of all, we live in a bit of the core universe. Also, these are the regions of the universe where all the astrochemistry is taking place, building up both simple and complex molecules. You get stars forming in these regions, letting us study the building blocks of galaxies. And around some of these stars, you get planets forming, which is rapidly becoming a really important part of astronomy with the number of exoplanets detected. It's going to be an absolutely huge field in the next few years. Then if you think about it, if you add complex molecules and planets together, you could maybe end up with life, which definitely makes the cool universe a very interesting thing to study. And finally, as I mentioned earlier, due to the effects of redshift, we get to study what's happening in other galaxies in processes that have higher energies than what we term cool universe in the sort of local universe. We get those completely as a bonus. So that's what's interesting about the cool universe.